This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, world leaders focus on Islamic State during talks at the UN General Assembly. Immigration grows in the United States. A massive marine reserve is on the way.
The New Zealand government will establish a 620,000 square kilometre ocean sanctuary in the Kermadec region. It is truly a special place, and we want to keep it that way.
You can own a piece of Hollywood. We'll explain coming up. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The United States is imposing financial sanctions against major Islamic State leaders and financial figures, also designating additional individuals and groups as terrorist fighters. The Treasury and State Departments are implementing the penalties on a total of 30 individuals and groups, in what a senior Obama administration official describes as a real ramp-up by the U.S. to prevent the Islamic State from exploiting the global financial system. This is believed to be the most ambitious U.S. attempt yet to undercut the Islamic State group's financial support. On the sidelines of the 70th U.N. General Assembly session Tuesday, President Obama took part in a summit for the anti-IS coalition. VOA correspondent Margaret Beshear talked about it with International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
We had the president here. There were more than 100 countries that joined him at this summit on countering ISIL. And he announced that three more countries have joined the coalition, Nigeria, Tunisia, and Malaysia. So now there are about 65 countries that are working to fight this terrorist group. President Obama said about two dozen countries are contributing to the military campaign, and that there has been some progress in the past year. The Iraqi military, with help from the coalition, has liberated towns in Kirkuk and Tikrit, and so that's a positive sign. And even in Syria, there's new pressure being put on ISIL strongholds in the city of Raqqa.
This particular meeting isn't just isolated. I assume that these are ongoing discussions.
Well, it's sort of a follow-up meeting to last year at UNGA. The president chaired a session in the UN Security Council where a resolution was adopted on stemming the flow of foreign fighters across borders and on trying to halt financing to them. And there was a session, I believe, in February at the White House on terrorism, and then this is sort of a follow-up to both of those events. And it was kind of an assessment meeting where they assessed where the gaps are from last year and what needs to be done still.
Speaking of flows across borders, in a related matter, we have this large migration issue happening in Europe, and I understand that that's going to have some discussion at the UN.
Yeah, there's going to be a major meeting that the Secretary General of the United Nations is hosting on the migration and refugee crisis, and it will bring together numerous countries. We heard from the Hungarian foreign minister, Peter Szijjártó, who spoke to reporters, and he said that Hungary, which has been receiving many migrants and refugees, they are going to propose tomorrow that instead of just European quotas on accepting refugees and migrants, there should be what he was calling world quotas, and that all major international players should accept some of the migrants and refugees. And you may know that his country has been criticized, really, for the way they've treated some of the migrants and refugees who've arrived there in recent months. And they've been criticized also for building walls on their borders with Serbia and Croatia to keep them out, fences, really. But he sort of pushed it aside and said, look, part of being a state is that you protect your borders, and so that's what we're trying to do. So he wouldn't accept the criticism on the fence.
VOA UN correspondent Margaret Beshear speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Social media is reacting to the anti-terrorism summit. G. Abby Lee is here to tell us what people are tweeting about. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
What's a good handle to follow on the event?
Well, this one is no-brainer. The United Nations official account at UN is a great one to follow for all UN-related events. The UN sent out this tweet earlier Tuesday. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to hashtag CVE Summit. Addressing violent extremism goes to heart of UN mission. Now, CVE stands for Countering Violent Extremism.
CVE, I see. Mm-hmm. Now, what about from President Obama and Secretary Kerry's accounts?
Well, both are great guesses because President Obama did host the event, but he didn't tweet about it. But Mr. Kerry did. He sent out this tweet. Eliminating ISIL will take time, but as POTUS said, hashtag CVE summit today marked emergence of movement united in degrading, destroying ISIL.
Gee, there is a new Twitter account floating around that's getting a lot of attention today, right?
Absolutely. We can't end this segment without talking about Edward Snowden joining Twitter sphere. We're talking about the NSA whistleblower, and he's on Twitter at Snowden, and his account is already verified. He has about 620,000 followers as of now, but he follows only one account. And can you guess what it is?
Well, I'll take a shot. Probably the one that has been closely following him on and offline.
Exactly. He's following the official account for the National Security Agency at NSAGOV on Twitter. And although NSA has been on Twitter for much longer, it has only about 90,000 followers.
Is there any word on what was Snowden's first tweet?
Yes, the first tweet was sent out around noon Eastern Standard Time, and it read, "Can you hear me now? ? That's been retweeted nearly 70,000 times already. Ray?
Thank you very much, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Heavy fighting raged near Kunduz City Airport Tuesday as Afghanistan National Security Forces, backed by U.S. airstrikes, engaged in a counteroffensive to regain control of the northern city, taken by the Taliban on Monday. A spokesman for the U.S.-led NATO alliance confirmed it carried out airstrikes to eliminate a threat to coalition and Afghan forces around Kunduz. Speaking in Kabul, President Ashraf Ghani said that national forces have made quick advances, retaking control of several buildings, and that airstrikes have inflicted heavy casualties on the opposition. Nasir Shansab is an expert on Afghan affairs and author of the book called Silent Trees, a novel about war-torn Afghanistan. He spoke with International Edition's Susan Yaki.
We all, stunned that it happened, but the point is that Afghanistan is on a sliding scale, and things like this will happen more often in the future, I'm afraid.
Why is this happening now?
Well, I assume that the Taliban prepared themselves better than they usually do, and that the Afghan authorities, as so often happens in Afghanistan, underestimated their shortcomings and overestimated their possibilities. That's an Afghan trait, and they usually have then a warped appreciation of their understanding of their situation, and things like this happens.
Is the leadership of the Taliban changing?
Well, the leadership has already changed because we now know that Mullah Omar is dead, and a person by the name of Mullah Massoud has taken over the leadership. I assume that the new leadership wants to establish itself as a firm leadership and are going on a hard line, I think.
What does that mean?
That means they want to show their strength, they want to show their determination to the people, and they want to tell the people indirectly that they are the right leadership.
What role should the international community play in Afghanistan?
I think that the international community always looked at Afghanistan simplistically and optimistically. I think that it was way too early when the decision was made that the war should be handed over to the Afghan security forces, that train has left the station, and I'm not sure whether we can reverse it now.
That's Nasir Shansab speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. A new study by the Washington-based Pew Research Center says 50 years after landmark immigration legislation was enacted into law, almost 59 million immigrants have arrived in the United States, pushing to almost 14% the number of people who were foreign-born. It says the number of immigrants who arrived in the U.S. between 1965 and 2015 exceeded the flood of arrivals of mostly European immigrants during the 19th and early 20th centuries. And while attention is focused on immigrants entering the country from Latin America, the Pew Research study finds that flow has slowed in recent years, and the percentage of Hispanics in the U.S. will actually decline to 31% by 2065. Meanwhile, it projects Asian immigrants will make up 38% of the foreign-born population by 2065 and be the largest immigrant group by 2055. Mike Mather of the Washington-based Population Reference Bureau told International Edition's Victor Beatty, if current demographic trends continue, future immigrants and their descendants will be an even bigger source of growth, accounting for most of the population increase, more than 100 million, as the U.S. population grows to 441 million by 2065.
It's immigrants and the children of immigrants that are keeping the population growing in the United States. It's keeping our population relatively young compared to what's happening in parts of Europe and Japan and some other countries that don't have high levels of immigration and don't have relatively high birth rates. So it's having a significant impact on population growth, and it's changing the racial ethnic makeup in this country.
There are mixed views, according to this study, among Americans who have been here for a generation or more about this flood of immigration. The U.S. has long been known as a nation of immigrants. I think this study indicates that one in five are foreign-born today in this country. To what do you attribute the mixed view among Americans who have been here a while, and what impact might this have on politics?
I think that part of it has to do with, you know, when the economy's running smoothly and the unemployment rate is low, we tend to have more positive views about immigration. We obviously just got over a bad economic patch, and I think so the recession may have played some role in people's negative views about people coming in and potentially taking people's jobs. But you also have to consider that back in the early 1900s, people were very much against many immigrants coming in from Europe. Today, many people oppose high levels of immigration from Latin America. But people's views change over time, and I expect that over time people will change their views about immigration from Latin America, just as they have about immigrants from Europe.
Well, 50 years on after this landmark immigration law was passed in 1965, do you think any of the authors had any idea what this would portend?
No, I would say that they probably had no idea that they had opened the gate, so to speak, to the number of immigrants and their children that are currently here in the United States. So there are certainly some unintended consequences, I think, related to that legislation. It's obviously accounted for most of our growth for the past 50 years.
One of the most interesting findings in this Pew Research study was not so much that Hispanics were making a larger part of the population. It's the Asian immigrants that are projected to make up the larger share of all immigrants in the next 50 years.
Yeah, and I will say that it's difficult to project 50 years out into the future what's going to occur. A lot of that is driven by immigration policy. It's driven by what happens not only with the economy in the United States, but what's happening with the economy in those sending countries. So it's hard to predict, but if current trends continue, it's true that Asians will make up the majority of the foreign-born population maybe by mid-century.
Is this a somewhat of a quiet revolution? Not too many people are talking about it.
No, I don't think they are. And to be honest, I think people pay much more attention to immigrants from Latin America who are much more likely to have less education. Many may not have graduated from high school. And so there's more attention paid to immigrants who many feel are taking benefits that should be going to U.S.-born citizens and so on.
Martha says most of the Asian immigrants coming to the U.S. are from the region's two largest countries, China and India, with large pools of high-skilled workers and students. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. With a threatened shutdown of the U.S. government looming, there is very little time remaining for Congress to approve a stopgap spending bill and get it to President Obama's desk. Federal spending authority expires at midnight Wednesday, Washington time. Unless both houses of Congress act, a partial shutdown would ensue. Votes in the Senate and House of Representatives are expected Wednesday before the deadline. At issue is funding for Planned Parenthood, the nation's top provider of abortions. Republicans sought to defund the organization, but Senate Democrats repeatedly blocked bills to do so. Planned Parenthood offers a range of women's reproductive health services. Meanwhile, turmoil continues in global markets. Business correspondent Alexis Christophorus is in New York with details.
Global stock markets reached a two-year low on Tuesday as the outlook for raw material prices and emerging markets remained soft. U.S. biotech shares remained under pressure as well. Asian share markets came under intense selling pressure, with Japan's Nikkei losing over 4% following a steep retreat on Wall Street the prior day. Commodity prices edged up but held near multi-year lows. Concern over an economic slowdown in major raw material consumer China. U.S. stocks closed slightly higher, but it was a choppy session, and an early rally in biotechs faded to deal the sector its eighth straight drop. The S&P 500 managed to barely snap a five-session losing streak, but remained close to August lows that analysts see as a key support level.
As the markets go down, Google is hoping to go up with something new.
Now it's Google's turn to come out with some new products. The launch of the phones, the Nexus 6P and the Nexus 5X, come a day after Apple reported first weekend sales of its new iPhones, and they were at a record. Google said the new version of Android called Marshmallow will roll out to existing Nexus customers beginning next week. The Nexus 5X is made by South Korea's LG Electronics and the Nexus 6P by China's Huawei Technology. Both phones feature Google's new fingerprint sensor, Nexus Imprint, which is located on the back of the phone, and the phones are available for pre-order on the Google Store. And then, of course, there is the new tablet, the Pixel C tablet. That tablet will be available in time for the holiday shopping season on the Google Store as well.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Coming up, Hollywood memorabilia up for grabs. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Anemia, or a lack of iron in the body, leads to a reduction in the number of red blood cells, causing tiredness and other symptoms. To combat the problem, a Cambodian-Canadian venture is making a small, cheap iron fish to use inside of cooking pots. The lucky iron fish leaches small amounts of iron into the food and water while it cooks. Users say it helps how they feel.
I used to always feel very tired, but after starting to use the iron fish, bit by bit, I began having more energy.
Devot Haim with Lucky Iron Fish says the tool is made from recycled iron, costs about $5, and lasts for 5 years.
I hope that the Lucky Iron Fish will swim around the world where there is an iron deficiency.
Lucky Iron Fish plans to go global with its product, providing an iron fish to about 1 million families over the next 5 years. I'm Martin Seacrest from VOA's Living Better.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition in Washington. New Zealand will be creating one of the world's largest marine reserves to protect wildlife in the South Pacific. The Kermadec Sanctuary will cover 620,000 square kilometers of largely pristine ocean. All mining and fishing will be forbidden in the protected area, roughly the size of France. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Beneath its waters, which lie in between New Zealand and Tonga, is one of the world's biggest string of volcanoes. The reserve is home to an array of endangered wildlife, including dolphins, turtles and whales, while new marine species are regularly discovered. It's also an important breeding and feeding ground for seabirds, fish and invertebrates. The sanctuary will cover 15% of New Zealand's exclusive economic zone and is 50 times the size of the South Pacific country's largest national park. The announcement was made by New Zealand Prime Minister John Key, who's on a visit to the United Nations in New York.
It's my great pleasure to take this opportunity to announce the creation of what will be one of the world's largest and most significant fully protected nature reserves. The New Zealand government will establish a 620,000 square kilometre ocean sanctuary in the Kermadec region. It is truly a special place and we want to keep it that way.
The move will likely disappoint sections of the deep sea mining and fishing industries, which will be locked out of the enormous sanctuary. A spokesman for New Zealand's seafood sector said it would consider the implications of the decision. A Canadian resources firm has applied for a permit to prospect in the area. The New Zealand government has said the oceans had become the new frontier for environmental protection. Conservation groups have welcomed the Marine Reserve announcement, although they continue to criticise what they describe as Wellington's poor record on reducing its greenhouse gas emissions. The United Nations has made sustainable development a key focus. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Volkswagen announced plans Tuesday to refit up to 11 million vehicles worldwide affected by the emissions rigging scandal. The German carmaker also said that 1.8 million commercial vehicles are among those fitted with a sophisticated software to cheat on emission tests. Newly appointed chief executive Matthias Müller said Volkswagen would issue a factory recall in the next few days to refit diesel vehicles that contain the software in question. According to some analysts, the cost of the refit could exceed $6.5 billion. If you've ever wanted to own a piece of Hollywood history, this week, now's your chance. Some prized artifacts from Star Wars, Star Trek, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and even an actual Academy Award are up for bid in Hollywood. International Edition's David Byrd explains.
If you've ever wanted to own a part of movie history, you can bid this week at Profiles in History in Calabasas, California. Items from some of Hollywood's biggest blockbusters, including the original 1977 version of Star Wars, are up for bid. Brian Chanis is the head of acquisition for the auction house.
We have your usual suspects, things coming ranging from Star Wars, Star Trek, Jaws. We have Quint's harpoon rifle from Jaws. One of the iconic barrels, his machete, and just things from all over movie history that people clamor towards.
Brian Chanis says other items up for sale include the golden slave bikini Carrie Fisher wore when she was a captive of Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi, and her ship from the original Star Wars in 1977 is also on the block.
One of my favorite pieces actually came from Grant McCune, who won the Academy Award for visual effects in Star Wars. It's the very first spacecraft that you see in the opening sequence of the first Star Wars. And that one, we have an estimate of $200,000 to $300,000, but I suspect that it's going to be, you know, more in the maybe $500,000 range plus.
Indiana Jones's fedora and bullwhip and a motorcycle ridden by Daredevil Evel Knievel will also be sold. Brian Chanis says that Star Trek fans will have the chance to bid on original costumes worn by the late Leonard Nimoy as Spock in both the television show and in the Star Trek movies.
Original series, second season tunic, the velour one with all the braid, the insignia from Star Trek, the original series, great documentation. We also have a costume of his from Star Trek, the motion picture back in 1979 when he started doing the feature films. Then, of course, we also have his costume when he mind-melded with the humpback whale in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. So, you know, we have things, you know, covering his earlier years as Spock and also his later years.
Nimoy died February 27th at age 83. And if you've ever wanted your very own Academy Award, Brian Chanis says you have the chance to own a very rare one.
Only the third Best Actress Oscar ever presented. It was for Norma Shearer for the film The Divorcée from 1930. And, you know, rarely do you see an Oscar of that caliber reach the auction block. It's one of the very first that was presented. It's got the Belgian marble base. They look a little bit different than the cylindrical bases of today's. But that one we have at $150,000 to $250,000.
Other items in the catalog include Russell Crowe's costume as Maximus in Gladiator, Angelina Jolie's custom wetsuit and gun rig from Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, and a complete Spartan costume, including helmet, shield, and leather girdle from The 300. Or you could bid on a full Spider-Man costume from Spider-Man 3. Music fans can bid on John Lennon's British fireman's coat, a Gibson Firebird guitar played and signed by Carlos Santana, or an authentic amulet charm made with Jimi Hendrix's hair. The auction runs through October 1st. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Trade and Development Agency awarded a grant on September 25th to NextGen Solawazi Limited to support the development of a 60-megawatt solar photovoltaic power plant in Shinyanga, a city in northwestern Tanzania. The grant supports a feasibility study that will evaluate the technical and commercial viability of the power plant, conduct environmental and social impact assessments, and provide the necessary analysis for NextGen Solawazi to seek implementation financing. This project is critically important to Tanzania's economic growth as, according to the World Bank, only 15% of its population has access to electricity. USTDA is pleased to continue our work with NextGen Solawazi to develop renewable energy in Tanzania, said Director Leocadia Zak, who signed the grant agreement along with NextGen Solawazi Limited Managing Director Mayank Bargava. This project presents a valuable opportunity to draw upon U.S. technical expertise to deploy new energy generation capacity in Shinyanga. Tanzania's National Strategy for Poverty Reduction and Growth has identified limited power generation capacity and poor electricity access as the most critical issue for development, said Mr. Bargava. Energy generation from the solar plant will not only electrify an estimated 210,000 households, but also act as a catalyst to attract other commercial enterprises by providing reliable, plentiful, and cheaper electricity. The feasibility study will be undertaken by U.S. engineering and technical consulting company Clean Energy Consulting and Education in Phoenix, Arizona. The project builds upon the agency's previous collaboration with NextGen Solawazi, including the provision of an owner's engineer who is supporting efforts to build a 5-megawatt solar plant in Kigoma, Tanzania. Both of these projects advance the goals of Power Africa, a U.S. government-led initiative to add cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity across the subcontinent. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Tanzania, to help provide clean, safe, and renewable energy to meet the needs of a growing and vibrant population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's